Hi everyone, this is Catherine from the Media Education Lab, and you're listening to the Courageous Rhode Island Podcast, the show that finds common ground, builds media literacy skills, and encourages curiosity for the people of Rhode Island. In this episode, our host Renee Hobbs talks to Michael Jagoda, who serves as URI's Director of Public Safety, as well as Chief of Police. He also served as Commander of the Connecticut State Police at the time of the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012. Today, you'll hear Jagoda talk about current challenges facing law enforcement, the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes, and law enforcement's involvement in violence prevention.
Hey, I'm Renee Hobbs, and welcome to the Courageous RI podcast. Today, I am here with Michael Jagoda. He is the University of Rhode Island's Director of Public Safety, and he's the Chief of the Police. And before this, he was a commander in charge of the Connecticut State Police. And during the mass shootings, Sandy Hook Elementary School, that we all remember back in 2012. And he was awarded a meritorious commendation from the Sandy Hook Elementary School for the work he did in that horrific massacre. Michael, one of the things when we started the Courageous RI project is we were really eager to engage law enforcement professionals with educators, librarians, small business owners, members of our diverse Rhode Island community. And in a way, one of the reasons why I'm so excited about the potential of Courageous RI is because I think we need more dialogue between law enforcement and citizens. And I wonder from your point of view, what makes this a particularly important and challenging time to be in the field of law enforcement?
Well, Renee, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak with you today. You know, and I want to congratulate you and Pam, you know, on the grant that you received for this. This is a great thing that you're doing. And you know, when we talk about communication, I think that's, we see a lot of challenges with communication, and we, especially in law enforcement, when we talk about building trust and confidence with our community members, with our partners, communication. And I think that's what this program is all about, is about effective communication, listening to understand. You know, we sometimes listen to respond, and I think we really need to change the way we communicate and listen to understand and value, embrace and appreciate everyone's, you know, uniqueness and differences. So some of the challenges that we're seeing in law enforcement right now, you know, I still think we're seeing some challenges with what happened with the George Floyd incident. That's, you know, well over 2 years ago. Building those trust and confidence, especially with our underrepresented multi-language community of members. That's one of the big things that we're working on in terms of community policing. And for me, it's about not doing feel-good type of program. It's about listening to our community members and addressing their concerns and their issues, and in partnership, addressing those in collaboration to again, to build that trust and confidence, but also to solve those issues. And then the other part is the retention and recruitment of really high quality people that want to come into our field. I think it's so important that we go out and we recruit the right people in terms of values that we want to have in this field. So those are kind of the challenges that we're having right now, you know, before COVID and post COVID, now that we're seeing those two different things. So we have to continue to not rest on our laurels in terms of what we did yesterday. We have to continue to build those relationships with our community members.
Right. You know, of course, one of the things I'm fascinated about is how media shape our ideas about what fields like law enforcement are like. And I've been fascinated at how since George Floyd, there's been a very clear effort to make the law enforcement stories we see on TV kind of be more realistic, be more complex, be more humane. I'm watching a show. I don't know if you're watching this, but I really do love it. I'm plugging it for our listeners because it's just, it's such a good, not everybody watches crime media, right? But
right.
East New York.
Okay.
East New York is worth watching because of the way it depicts the relationships and the humanity of law enforcement professionals and the complex relation they have with the community, right? And it's good TV drama, but it also feels like it's reflecting the efforts that you're making, you and law enforcement are making to attract the best and brightest, to find ways to connect to the community and to overcome people's fear, you know, fear, anxiety, and doubt. So just saying that's, we might in one of the Courageous episodes, we might use a little clip from that show just to talk a little bit about how entertainment media gives us messages about crime and about violent extremism and about law enforcement. But getting to talk to real people, that's the best. So now you and I recently attended this really interesting meeting. It was called United Against Hate. It featured folks from the FBI, folks from the the U.S. District Attorney's Office. And it was really designed to show how collaboration between federal and local officials and community members can help to reduce hate, the hate that leads to violence. Why is this work important? And thinking back about that, in that program, what insights stood out to you?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, the increase in violence directed towards hate because of certain races, gender, you know, religious, is very concerning. And what that workshop really did was we really talked about strategies to prevent, you know, and to respond to hate crimes and incidents. You know, we've seen an increase in it. We've seen an increase in the anti-Semitic incidents that we've experienced, especially in our region. You know, it all goes back to, again, building trust and confidence with our community members. So I think it's important, you know, myself being an FBI National Academy graduate, I think what you see is a true commitment by law enforcement. You had the FBI there, you had the U.S. Attorney's Office there, you had local and state law enforcement. The commitment that we want to make in terms of not allowing this to happen in our communities and working in partnership with our community members to prevent this, to say there's no tolerance for it. And you're going to be held responsible if you're going to, in terms of hate crimes or hate incidents. So here at URI, we've made a commitment. We actually have a civil rights hate crimes officer. He's a sergeant, and he works with our U.S. Attorney's Office and with our AG, our local Attorney General's Office, who has a hate crimes unit. And when we see something, it could be graffiti, could be something related to a property crime of a certain individual, we work with both of those, our federal and our state partners, in determining if that is a hate crime, and then finding out who's responsible for it. Because once we see fear kind of injected into our community, that creates a lot of mistrust. It creates, we should be living in fear. Our community members should feel safe. They should feel appreciated. They should feel valued. And I think once we show that, you know, in terms of safety and security, we're not going to tolerate that as a community, not only as a law enforcement, but as a community. I think it's very important. You know, I think I might have talked about this a little bit in terms of our community at URI. We're very fortunate to live in a, it's not perfect, but we discourage that kind of behavior, those kind of actions, and we're going to hold those people accountable for those types of actions. And we have our values here at the URI community are very, you know, the transformational goals that we have in terms of appreciating everybody is truly remarkable.
So in some ways, that idea that coming together as a community to kind of to express where we draw the line, what kinds of communication are unacceptable, what we do not want to see in our community, that's kind of an effort that involves both law enforcement and community. You know, for me, the big takeaway from that event was how beautifully they drew the line between hate speech, which is constitutionally protected by the First Amendment, and hate incidents, and then hate action, hate crime. And the way in which I began to see, as they explained it, it's a continuum, right? And so while hate speech is protected, hate speech is an indicator of hate incidents, which is an indicator of hate crime. And that relationship between those three dimensions was, I thought, beautifully kind of explained. But it's a complex, there's some complexity to that relationship there. And I think the public doesn't have a good understanding of the relationship between why hate speech is of concern because of the way it can lead to hate incidents and hate crime. In your career, how have you encountered the relationship between speech and action?
Yeah, you make a good point about it being complex, especially being a state institution, you know, where we're a little bit different than a private higher ed, where, you know, there's a First Amendment right, and we have to really weigh that, the checks and balance of making sure that free speech doesn't become discriminatory, doesn't become biased, doesn't become racial in tone, and discriminate and become a hate incident or a hate crime. So, you know, you talk very eloquently about being at a fine line, and I think it's very important that when we're working with our community, that we kind of set the ground rules in terms of what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. And we've seen that in terms of protest, you know, in the past 18, 24 months, and making sure that those, you know, they have the right to express the First Amendment, but it doesn't overstep and become a criminal element.
Right, right. One of the things that the FBI said was that they encouraged people to report hate incidences. And how does that work on URI's campus? Like, how do you find out about these incidences? What's the process that occurs usually?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of, you know, punching here at a theme in terms of, again, building trust and confidence. So, you know, we have reporting mechanisms in terms of, you know, confidentiality and a tips hotline, and different things like that. But I think what our community members feel comfortable that we're going to take those seriously. We're going to that's important to us, that there's not going to be retribution or retaliation. So building those community policing outreach programs are so important. That's where we meet each other and we feel comfortable. And it's not the first time, you know, when we're reporting a crime or incident, that's not the first time we're coming into interaction with each other. You know, we break down those barriers and we trust each other and that we're going to do the right thing. So I think it really starts, again, with community outreach, community policing, reaching out to different groups, not only, you know, in terms of HRL, housing and residential life, but really our student groups, going to student senate, going to faculty senate, meeting with them and, you know, talking through some of those barriers or challenges that we have. I think that's a start. Of course, we have other mechanisms where you can report in terms of calling 911, calling our administrative number. We have a tips line that's anonymous. And like the U.S. attorney mentioned in the FBI, we'll investigate those, even though if you don't want to make a formal complaint, we'll investigate those.
You know, you said something that, so you're reminding me of something you said in the meeting that I thought was super powerful. And you said something like, it's the community relationships over time that builds the trust. So people feel comfortable they're reporting something about their grandson or their brother-in-law or somebody in the neighborhood, they feel, you know, concerned. They're concerned enough to report, but they're also concerned for the person, the human being that they're worried about, that they're afraid might engage in violence. And you said something really, I thought, very powerful. And you said something like, on a university campus, you have a turnover of the whole population,
right,
basically,
right,
every 4 years or every 6 years. And I thought, oh, that makes the communication job like much harder, or maybe much more continual. How do they find ways to connect? What are some of the most successful sort of student outreach programs that have, or approaches that you've had success with?
Right. So I think it's actually energizing for us as police officers, as public safety, because we you know, sometimes you get stale and you kind of rest, you know, I've made these relationships, we've done these programs, why do we have to do them again? But now we're dealing with a new community every 4 years, or really every year. And it really energizes our officers. And we talk about being part of a, you know, as faculty, you know, you talk about what you want from your students in terms of innovation and creativity. And that's what I ask my officers, to be more creative, be more innovative. And so we get a lot of feedback from them in terms of community outreaching programs and different things that work. And they have students, they have children that are here at the university or other universities, and they understand what our students are looking for. We've made a commitment at this university in terms of a full-time community police officer, Paul Harahan, who really has a great rapport with you know, our faculty, our staff, and our students, and listens to their concerns and engages them on a daily basis and really gets positive feedback. So it you know, it can be something simple as dealing with food insecurities. You know, people mm-hmm. wouldn't think that we would have that here on a college campus, but we do. We have a lot of food insecurities, and maybe, you know, participating in raising money for our food pantry or having food out on the quad. And then we break down those barriers with those conversations just to get to know each other.
Mm-hmm. So beautiful.
Different events like that. Mm-hmm. You know, we do a lot of events with our student organizations, with our Greeks. So we have a great, we have a CREST program where we do active shooter with our faculty and our staff. So I think it's very important in terms of the holistic part of that. So again, the officers are really, they're energized by this community, by this, the energy that's here. So wow. I think that's important. And for me as a leader, you know, the George Floyd incident and COVID, I don't see those as I think it's an opportunity to reimagine policing. You know, look at, instead of the guardian mindset, the warrior mindset, we look at the guardian mindset in terms of how can we do better? How can we look at those incidents and learn from those incidents and make our profession better and you know, more collaboration with our community members.
So beautiful. You know, that's the protect and serve ethos that we really is essential for societies to flourish, right? And that protect and serve together makes a huge contribution, especially I think in your work in dealing with mass shootings and the campus shootings we've been encountering recently, most recently just the Michigan State event. And I think the public might not fully appreciate how much behind the scenes training and preparation you do, like as prevention. Can you talk a little bit about how do law enforcement professionals think about prevention? Because we think you deal with violence, but we don't always think about law enforcement being involved in violence prevention. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, you know, you know, when it comes to like active shooters now, and something that's very concerning, we're not seeing a decrease in them. You know, it's alarming. The FBI doesn't have all their statistics out yet for 2022 yet, but we saw about a 52% increase in mass shootings. And the FBI really defines that as a incident, you know, single incident where three or more people are killed because of a firearm. This year already, I think we're well over 75 mass shootings for, and we're not even, you know, first 3 months of the year. So it's something that's, you know, you mentioned my background in terms of Sandy Hook, the role I played there. You know, we also, in my short career with the Connecticut State Police in 1998, you know, we had the lottery shooting in Newington where four people were killed. And then in 2010, we had the Manchester distributors and up the Hartford distributor shooting up in Manchester where eight people were killed. So when I hear people say it can't happen here, and then of course Sandy Hook, where I you know took an active role and I was the incident commander command post there, we had 26 people killed there, and we're seeing more and more mass shootings happen daily. So it's very concerning. So in terms of prevention, you know, I think we owe it to our community members to help train them. We've made a commitment to train our officers. We have a couple of officers who are instructors that went through the FBI training, and they are active shooter instructors. And we train regularly as a police department. We've trained other police departments. We've given them their equipment to make sure they can properly respond. And we have a training program called CREST. It's a civilian response to an active shooter event. And we train our students, our faculty, and our staff how to respond. You know, if it doesn't happen here on campus, we're seeing about 24% of all active shooters happen on in an educational setting, K through 12 and higher ed. But we want to give you the practical skills to really to respond properly to help you and your family members get out of an active shooter event. So we put on a program. It's about an hour and a half. And we've also incorporated the Stop the Bleed program. It's a national campaign that came out of the Las Vegas shooting where a lot of those bystanders were injured. Some of them didn't survive their wounds because of going in shock and bleeding to death. So the Stop the Bleed program is a tourniquet where you can, you know, citizens now can help apply a tourniquet in terms of getting you to a trauma level care, getting you to a hospital, and people are surviving those injuries now because of that.
Because so when the public has knowledge, a little bit of knowledge can go a long way at a moment of crisis. Oh, wow. Yeah, you're making me very inspired to try that.
The other part of the prevention is really we've changed the way we, you know, and I won't go into all the details, but the way we patrol our campus in terms of we have sectors now and we have officers assigned to certain sectors and they get to know the people in those sectors. They get to deal with our community members to deal with and address quality of life issues. And the omnipresence alone creates, you know, it's preventable. It, you know, when somebody wants to think about doing something and they see that presence, the visibility of our officers out there. And we've taken our officers out of the cruisers and we put them on foot beats and we put them on our electric bicycles. We have four electric bicycles that do about 25-30 miles an hour. And the officers love those and they get out. And again, it's our community members feel like they can approach the officers better in terms of they're more approachable from being on foot and in a bicycle than in a cruiser.
Wow. Isn't that interesting? So all of those strategies to increase trust are the result of you recognizing that you are part of the community. Your officers are part of the community and kind of the opportunities for person-to-person engagement can really make a difference. And I feel like learning about the active shooter drill opportunities to learn makes me think I wish I knew how to put on a tourniquet and why don't I know? And that's right. Like not that hard to learn. And so I feel like learning about small things that I can do as a citizen to be more prepared. I feel like the culture of kind of people feeling like helpless and hopeless and there's nothing we can do. This is something Courageous RI participants come together in our dialogues every 2 weeks to try to solve. Because if you feel helpless and hopeless, you may be more likely to be a victim of crime, right?
Yeah, no,
if you feel empowered.
What you do matters. What you do matters. So, and we really empower you in those trainings in terms of giving you different options, giving you the practical skill set, giving you different plans of action to really help you. You know, sometimes when we have an incident like that, the stress of that incident will take your muscle memory, take your fine motor skills over. And this really gives you that, you know, that clear thinking.
Love that. Love that. I feel like I might put that on my 2023 learning plan, right? Because I like to keep
that.
Learning. And I think this is a small form of learning that I could do that would help me better understand police officers. Do you know, Chief Degoda, that last year was the first year I ever rode in a police car as a ride along. Out in Austin, Texas, where we were doing some work with the Austin police, helping them use video more effectively for learning. And I learned so much from the ride along, and my appreciation for police skyrocketed. And I thought, boy, they need to have incredible communication skills to deal with all these people in distress.
I think that's a number one skill set. You know, we talked about it. I went to a active shooter conference yesterday and we got to talk to a lot of SROs, you know, mostly K-12. Mm-hmm. And the most important skill that we talked about was the communication skills, really talking to the students and the faculty and staff, really having those really effective communications in terms of listening and hearing, you know, dealing with, you know, some of our students that have FAIR and have, you know, different things that are going on in their life and really listening and trying to address it.
I think we need to do a session in Courageous RI just with the school resource officers and better understand the skills they have and the skills they bring into those communication relationships with children and young people. What a good idea. I'm going to put that on my agenda too. Listen, I'm sorry we're out of time now, but I really enjoyed talking with you, Chief Degoda. Thank you so much for your service, not just to URI, but to all of us here in Rhode Island. And thanks for being part of the Courageous RI community. Bye now.